are listening to episode 4 of the Talentopoly podcast, where we discuss some of the best links posted on Talentopoly.com each week. I'm Jared Brown. I started Talentopoly.com. I'm on Twitter at Jared Brown. And from time to time, I write pointless things on jaredbrown.me.
And I'm Stephen Dixon, a web designer and front-end developer from the UK. And you can check me out on Twitter at Stephen M. Dixon and also on my website, stephenmdixon.com.
And my name is Stephen M. Dixon. My name is Brandon Corbin, and I am a designer developer, and you can follow me on Twitter at Brandon Corbin.
Nice.
I change it up. I can't stand the consistency.
Fair enough.
I was about to say I'm nobody, but maybe I'll save that for next time. Yeah, I don't like to talk about myself, so.
Well, we like to start things off right with a segment about what we're drinking. As previous listeners know, we always like to drink usually something alcoholic, but not always. Beer, wine, tea, soda, whatever. And we will bore you with the details about it. So, Brandon, I'm sure you're drinking some kind of wine.
I am.
This podcast. I am. Tell us about it.
This is a Bodega Norton. Shut up. Hey, listen, gentlemen. I know. It really just got Norton as the name, but if you look really closely, you can see that their name's actually Bodega Norton, and it's a Cabernet Sauvignon 2009 from Mendoza, Argentina. It's actually a really good wine, and unfortunately, I have no idea how much it cost because I just kind of went in and I was in a hurry because I knew I needed wine for tonight. But yeah, all in all, I would give it a yes.
I'm curious, where do you buy your wine from? Just anywhere? Or are you particular about it?
I have there's Tasteful Times and Fishers is a great place to go. And I walk in and I say, hey, I'm looking for a new cab. What do you have? And he tells me the story. He's like, yeah, this guy's a great winemaker. You know, he's like totally anti-establishment or whatever. And he makes these recommendations and they're all under $20, a majority of them. And I've been happy ever since. Other than that, there is another alcohol liquor establishment that I'll run into when I'm not in the mood to be like overwhelmed with wine knowledge and I just need to get, you know, sloppy drunk. but Tasteful Times and Fishers, and I think it's tasteful-times.com. I'm going to keep telling them I'm giving them props.
Yeah.
Hopefully give me free wine.
Yeah. Definitely got to work that angle. All right, Steve, what are you drinking tonight?
Okay, so if you noticed I had an alcoholic beverage in the first episode, then non-alcoholic, then alcoholic. So this week, I'm keeping up the tradition, non-alcoholic. It is Tropicana, orange, and mango. It is so sweet for my mouth, and I love it. Mm.
Sweet for my mouth.
Yes.
So sophisticated. No matter what you say, you sound sophisticated. It's amazing.
Awesome, thank you.
So moving on. I love Belgian beers, and tonight I am drinking a triple from New Belgium Brewing Company. It's a very nice beer, great triple, and I'm almost done with it, so I think I'm going to need another one.
You just got that like 30 seconds ago.
I did. I told you I love this beer.
What's the percentage on it?
Let's see.
17.
7.8%.
Wow. Okay.
So, see, that's why I don't drink a lot of beer because, you know, I'm 13.7 for mine.
Doesn't pack the punch that you need, Brandon.
Tequila has like 30%, so.
Yeah, I know. Well, and tequila makes me do stupid things and get naked, so I avoid tequila for the last few years, especially during Christmas parties at work.
And podcasts, hopefully.
Mm-mm. No, many times I've done the podcast naked.
Oh.
That's why I don't do video.
Right. That's why we will never do video.
From now on.
We can do video, but not film like from our waist down.
Right.
I don't think you want to look at my man boobs, honestly, but, you know, whatever. To each his own.
Yeah, there was a rumor. I think it was SNL. It was probably an urban legend or something, but they were talking about how some of the cast members through the years have done the, you know, that news segment they do on SNL. And they would do that without any pants on. I heard that somewhere. That must be true. I saw it on
the internet. Yes, I heard it on the internet.
Yeah, it's in a movie or on the interwebs, so it's true.
We need to come up with a new one, by the way. Interwebs and internets is now obviously getting old. What's the new one? What's the new one? I'm 35, so I'm like ancient.
Interbs.
And what?
Interbs.
interbs?
Is that like intertubes?
Yes. I don't know.
You just made interbs. It up.
Yes.
Oh, it sounds like a STD.
Copyright of StephenMDixon.com. Interbs. Use it today.
Good one.
How many of these non-alcoholic drinks have you had so far, Steve?
I don't know.
I think you've knocked back too many.
I'm having them in shot glasses. not really. It's just in a big glass.
Okay. So moving on, I'm kind of excited to start talking about some of the new things that are coming out on Talentopoly. I'll just talk about it real quick here. I kind of think that this podcast is one avenue of what I'm trying to do with Talentopoly, which is to keep devs, designers, and IT folks up to date on what's going on in their industry, what the new stuff is that they should know about, care about, or maybe just read on their lunch break, whatever. And we're going to be releasing a couple of new features in the coming weeks and months that help you find better ways to keep up to date on these things. So you don't always have to go to the website. I realize that people don't always have the time to go there every day. Hopefully the podcast is one of those ways every week you can stay up to date on this stuff. But we're looking at having curated lists that go out as emails that are specific to skill sets or areas of interest. We're looking at doing chats. So we're going to have a chat room that's going to be launching soon. We've got a couple of cool things that we're baking up. So
here's the interesting thing about Talentopoly and my perspective is for the longest time, delicious.com/popular was a thing that I would always go to every day. Now that it's been gamed and I've been searching for something else, I'm finding that Talentopoly is kind of that source for me, because all the things that I want to know and hear about end up right there on the page. So what I think you're doing is actually, you know, kick ass. And the email thing, we've talked about it, but I think the email is a huge thing to kind of continually pull people back in. So that's awesome. I look forward to them.
Yeah, it actually, some of this is coming out of conversations with some of the real users and finding out what's working for them and what's not, and trying to do more of what's working. So,
good job.
Excellent.
Good job.
Thanks, Steve.
I had to chime in there, but no, yeah. It is awesome. So, looking forward to it.
All right. So, I'm going to try doing something a little different this episode. And if not all of the articles that we talk about each week are posted by Talentopoly members other than the three of us, you know, a couple of them are outside of us. Hopefully that will grow in the coming weeks. But if an article is posted by somebody else, we're going to give you attribution. So we're going to say your name next to the article and say, hey, you're awesome. You posted this article.
Hey, do I get a browselet? Do you have a browselet?
We need to make one. You mean like a bookmarklet?
Yeah. Oh, that's what they're called. Sorry. I'm old.
Browselet.
A browselet. Yeah,
we're going to call it a browselet, and everybody's going to go, on, it's huh? Browselet. What is that?
Everybody? yeah, but okay. So I would love to have a bookmarklet. If I would, again, and I'm not a normal user, at least everybody says that. I would love to have a bookmarklet because I would use the hell out of it.
Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense. It's been on my to-do list of laziness that I never get around to doing. So
can I pre-populate anything in the URL?
Right now, no, because Okay. No, but soon you should be able to, and we will talk at length about that and bore our listeners in future episodes.
They're a bunch of nerds anyway. They'll appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's get to our first article here. HP punts on WebOS, discontinues touchpad, cuts Outlook. And basically this is, you know, if any good podcast this week is talking about this news, so we figured, well, we shouldn't skip over this. We've got to waste some time talking about it too. We're going to hopefully come up with a few things that haven't been said elsewhere, but we'll give it a try here. If you haven't heard, if you've been living under a rock, what happened is HP had their earnings call last week, and on that call they announced that they are going to discontinue the touchpad after it has been on the market for only 49 days. They decided that it was too much of a failure to continue to keep trying at it. And they are also going to discontinue all of their WebOS devices, including the phones. And they are exploring options, is how they put it, with WebOS, which has left most WebOS developers wondering what the heck has happened to our glorious platform and what do we do next. What do you guys think about this?
I have an opinion.
We want to hear it.
okay, so first off, I loved WebOS. Loved it. thought it was a brilliant operating system. And I think that they should open source it. I said, you know what? Go. Yes, of course, you can license it, and some people are going to pick it up, and it's never open source it, man. It's a great operating system. I would. I actually had the Palm pre-write when it came out because I was sincerely looking for something that could be a true iPhone competitor. The WebOS platform, I think, can do that. The hardware sucked. But the operating system is great, and I think this whole fiasco that happened proved that if you have a $99 good tablet, decent tablet, that you can sell the hell out of them.
Yeah, and lose a lot of money in the process.
Totally. But if they would have pre-planned it that way, yeah. Right? If they would have and take it at a loss, that's fine. Take it at a loss. Take it at a $50 loss. As long as you get enough people using them, then the web store takes off, or the app store. Right, and make your revenue kind of in that way too. You know, Apple's got best of both worlds. It's making a crap load of money off the App Store. It's making a crap load of money off the margins as well. Somebody has to give one of those up. And the touchpad proved that they could sell 250,000 of these damn things in a weekend if they charged $99 for them. So I was blown away by it. But again, WebOS is a great operating system, and the hardware, you know, whatever, it might have sucked. Let somebody who's really good at hardware like that stuff deal with it. But anyway, that's my opinion.
Right. Well, and at the very least, they've already ported Android over to this hardware. So for $99, you can have an Android tablet.
Yeah. But Android sucks compared to WebOS. And it's no offense. I mean, again, Android's a great thing for people who want to screw with their phones. Right, it's the same people who want to like hack their computers and mod their stuff and do all this and really get into the technology. And that's great, that's fine and dandy. But when it comes down to the true consumer, the true people that are going to make this product scale, it's got to be the people who can just take it and start using it. Right, I don't want to screw with it. I mean, I install an app and I have no idea where it is. Right, I don't want to have to worry about drivers. I don't, and really the WebOS kind of gave you that experience, like what Apple has, which is I can just get it and I can naturally use it. There's no learning curve. There's nothing.
I have my doubts that HP is going to seriously consider open sourcing WebOS.
They won't. No, they're going to fuck it up. Screw it up. And sorry. Oh. beep. Oh, wait, here.
We curse on this podcast. Totally fine.
Okay, good. But no, they're going to screw it up. And so that's where hopefully you could get, I don't know, you know, if they license it, that's great. I just don't see anybody, because you got Windows Phone 7, you've got Android, you have all of these others that, you know, I say do one thing good with it and just give it to the community.
Well, who's going to want to license this operating system and make devices for it if the owner of the OS has given up on at least the device side of it, exactly. Has completely given up? What totally. Type of ecosystem is left for this thing?
None. And that's why if you give it to the community, there will be people who will just do amazing things with it. So that's my whole take, because you're right. I mean, yeah.
It's a shame this has happened, though, because, I mean, HP, you know, like with WebOS, they're like the only company that has done or tried to do the same as Apple and done their own hardware with their own operating system, because Google hasn't done that per se, and obviously neither is Microsoft with Windows Phone 7. So it is a shame. And looking at the future products that were coming out, it kind of seemed that it could have worked. And it would have been interesting to see a company that, you know, previously did Windows PC hardware, you know, go ahead with WebOS. So it is a shame.
Yeah, I was pretty interested in seeing where it was going to go. I never was a true believer that WebOS is going to be a number two or number three in the game type of player. But they brought some cool things to the table. I like how they did multitasking. I never actually used a WebOS device, but looking at how, you know, screenshots. Yeah, it seemed like
a pleasure.
Very nicely done. A lot of nice innovation there that hopefully we'll find a home somewhere. What do you guys think? So Microsoft came out and tried to capitalize on the situation a day afterwards, and they said to anybody who is looking for a new platform, any of these registered WebOS devs looking to develop for another platform, we will offer you free devices, free tools, and free support to become a Windows Phone 7 mobile developer. And I know some people on Twitter were crying out that this was a disgusting move by Microsoft. Others were saying, you know, this is just Microsoft trying to be scrappy and trying to capitalize on the situation and try to win some developers over. Just quick thumbs up, thumbs down. Are you guys in favor of this move, or do you think it was just bad taste?
They got to figure out how to sell the phone somehow. or get rid of the phone somehow. I think it's a brilliant marketing tactic.
Okay.
Well, I mean, when I commented on an article on Talentopoly about this, I just put like how low, because I'm in disagreement with it, because I just think it's a typical move you see Microsoft do time after time with various things. You know, it's like, you know, they should just offer free Windows Phone dev tools at the moment anyway, because it's failing pretty much. It's falling flat on its face. So thumbs down.
Okay.
to be quick.
I was surprised that other platforms, and I know that, you know, Apple doesn't need to do this, but I was kind of surprised that other platforms didn't come out and kind of extend their open arms to these developers and do a similar thing. And right now, a lot of these webOS devs have got to feel like they got kicked in the teeth. So anybody coming their way with free stuff and saying, hey, come work on our platform and we'll help you do it and make it nice. And we're going to be around for a long time. If I were a webOS dev, I think that'd be a good thing, at least a good feeling. But our second article, 6 reasons the guy who's fixing your computer hates you. This article has absolutely zero educational value, but I personally loved this article. Reading through it, I was laughing so hard I was crying during most of this article. It hit so close to home for me, which may or may not be a good thing, but I thought this was hilarious. So let me run through the quick. Here are the 6 reasons. Number 6, future computer problems are not automatically my fault. Number 5, expect one more person for dinner, as in this is going to take a long time, so don't come up to me 30 minutes into me trying to get all the spyware and viruses and registry garbage off your computer in 30 minutes and say, hey, how much longer is it going to be? You should just expect I'm going to be here a long time. Number 4, assigning blame is not a priority. So all those times when you're working on somebody's computer and they're saying, well, you know, it had to have been my son. He puts all these games on there. Or, you know, I know exactly why this happened. I know who. No, this happened because you guys don't, all of you collectively are not taking care of this computer. This is no one person's fault, and it doesn't matter whose fault it is. Number 3, don't ask me how to make your 10-year-old PC faster. I love that one. I have a lot of stories about that one. Number 2, toolbars are bad news. And this guy was so right on when he said the first thing he does to figure out how ill a PC is, he loads up IE and counts the number of toolbars that have hijacked IE. He knows exactly from looking at that how bad the case is. And number 1, wipe means everything, which this was probably the only one that didn't really make a lot of sense to me, but I've never had to, at the point where you have to reformat somebody's computer, I usually just say, you know, all right, here you go. Here's how to do it. And I'm out of there. But did any of these ring really true for you guys? Which ones did you really like?
I like the, which one is it? Let me check. The 4th one. There's a pretty interesting screenshot on there. As I'm scrolling down the list and having a look.
My personal one is getting blamed, right? I go fix their computer, and then like 5 months later, they come back and they're like, hey, my computer's messed up. Whatever you did, broke it.
Right.
It's just like, are you kidding me?
It's slow again. Well, yeah, because you put all that crap back on it that was on there in the first place. And you're still using IE6, so everything that wants to pile in through that huge security vulnerability that is IE6 is just going to come right in.
I don't do it anymore. I got smart about it and said, you know what? I'm sorry. I can't help you. Get a Mac.
Right.
I thought that was going to be one of the reasons, because obviously it's like for PCs, man, this article, isn't it? I thought one of the 6 reasons is going to be like, because you've got a Mac or something like that.
Yeah, I love when you leave them all. So you've cleaned up the computer and you install Firefox on it, or Chrome nowadays. Traditionally it was Firefox. And you do the little walkthrough and say, see this orange icon down here? When you want to browse the web, when you want to load up your email or whatever, you click on that guy, and that's going to be your browser. And then you come back like a couple of weeks later, you know, you're over for dinner or whatever, you come back because the computer's messed up again, and you see they're still using IE, and Firefox has not been open since the day you left. That always gets me. I hate that.
You know what I found is helpful for converting people? Shame. I use shame all the time. So Kristen, this girl that I work with, that I sit kind of on the side of, she is always using IE. And so every day I shame her for it. And eventually I think she'll get it and she'll finally go and install Chrome. But shame people. Again, you're ruining the internet.
I've got a better way to do it.
Okay.
The next time that she gets up and she doesn't lock her computer when she gets up, gets a fax or something off the printer, you jump on that computer as fast as you can. You install the Google Chrome frame into IE. Yeah. And then it's problem solved.
Yes.
And she can still have the really crappy old IE interface and she won't be any the wiser, but problem solved.
Brilliant.
All right. Next article. Spin.js, which is an animated spinner, one of those progress spinner type deals, and it's built, supposedly, entirely in CSS.
No, it's not. It's a very cool thing, and just by its name, you can kind of tell that it's not just entirely in CSS because it's spinner.js. It's a lot of JavaScript, but nonetheless, it's very cool, and I suppose we need to give Tony Brown props for submitting it.
Yes, yep.
But it's a very cool library. I think I'm going to end up using it because we've all gone and, you know, did the search for free spinner library, you know, and you can design your own. This just does it all in CSS. You've got a nice little kind of control arm to be able to go and, you know, customize the way it looks. And it's kind of fun to play around with, like a really big one with fat, you know, circles, and it looks like a flower. But yeah, it's very cool. But I think the built entirely in CSS is incorrect if we're going to be, you know, detail-oriented
people.
Yeah,
we're going to be sticklers about it, which we will be. Did you get a chance to – I didn't get a chance to try this on different colored backgrounds, but I'm wondering how well that works.
The transparencies work great. Again, now I haven't tried it in IE6. Now, I knew they're using, I think, VML for it in IE6, but it does work in IE6. So, you know, most likely it probably would work, but who cares, you know? As long as it works like in IE8 and everything else, then, you know. But, yeah, the transparency or the backgrounds come through nicely.
Yeah, and on a side note, if you are supporting IE6, please stop. Because it's just giving those people an excuse to not upgrade. So
20% of revenue. How do you argue with that? How do you say, but 20% of our revenue comes from IE6 users?
What you do is you have a button that says, all right, you know, check out whatever the button is, log in. And really what it does is launch the Google Chrome frame installer right there. And just, they won't even know. Just say, yeah, this is what you have to do to buy stuff.
10% off. If you download this browser.
Exactly.
Seriously, that'd be an interesting move if a company actually did that.
I know. It kind of just hit me. So I think I might go talk to a couple of our clients and say, hey, you know, we can make your website significantly better if we don't have to adhere to this IE6 madness.
Well, and not even just that. Think about it from an ROI perspective. So you give 10% off. How much are you saving in developer time, which you are paying for, even if they're on salary?
That is
supporting it.
Well, because we're the developers.
Right.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Yeah.
I think there's something there. I think you deserve a raise, Brandon.
Yes. Please.
But that's totally unrelated, huh?
Yeah. Don't give me a raise, and that's a whole other conversation for a later date.
That's a different podcast entirely.
Yes, it is. That's on the 8to5 podcast.
Okay.
Plug. Okay, sorry.
All right. Thanks for catching the attribution for Tony Brown there. I totally glossed over that. Mozilla introduces web API and HTML API for accessing native mobile features. What this is Mozilla has proposed having an HTML, for HTML to have the ability to access native controls within phones or any sort of device. So imagine that you have an HTML5 app loaded up in Safari on your iPhone, and it could access the contact list in the phone. It could actually phone dial. You could record the phone call. You could access voicemail. You get the idea. Be able to go through, use camera, browse camera roll, all that good stuff. I got very excited when I read about this. I think that this this needs to happen now. This is badly needed.
You did get really excited, didn't you?
I did. I got very excited. This made my day.
Think about having access to the file browser, or not file browser, but in iPhone, you know, you could see that maybe Apple would give up control to access the camera. Obviously, there's no file browser per se, but to have access just to that the camera and the gallery would be huge for mobile apps. That's my problem, is I don't see Apple taking, you know, really jumping on this very quickly, mainly because it does impact sales for the App Store.
Well, I think this is a smart move by Mozilla, because they're getting this spec together. They're asking for input on it, and they're going to propose it as an HTML add-on to the spec.
You think it'd force them to then sure. have to include it? Yeah.
If it's an open web standard, I think Apple they've said publicly they want to support the open web and all those standards that come with it, and I think they have to if it becomes a standard.
But how long does it take somebody to be a standard, right? HTML5 is not going to be a standard until, what, 2016 or something crazy like that?
But it's a living standard now, as I understand it. So they continue to add to it, and the browsers are quickly trying to implement it. So, yeah. You know, maybe
I would love it. Don't get me wrong. I'm excited as hell. I would love to see it. I'm just I just fear that I won't see it on my iPhone. Then again, you know, Apple always has a way of surprising us. But my God, if you open up, you know, because we already have geolocation for the web apps, you know, I think you can even do some on the iPhone, at least some of the what is that, where it can tell your position?
The geolocation.
Well, no, not necessarily location, but like how the phone's angled. Gyroscope.
Yeah, gyroscope, accelerometer.
You know, if they would give us that, the ability to pull photos, then all of a sudden all of these photo apps would be able, you'd start being able to interact and start producing more on the phone, on the web apps. So I think that would be amazing to do. It really is a game changer if they can make this happen.
Yeah, and this is step one. This isn't going to happen overnight, but it's a promising step one. And to see Mozilla, one of the browser makers, actually introducing this gives me more hope for it. So trying to create cross-platform apps right now, if you want to do that, you have to look at things like, you know, and real cross-browser apps where you want to access the camera and whatnot. You need to use stuff like PhoneGap or Row Mobile. There are a couple of different ways you can do it. None of them are ideal. They compile down to code so you can put your stuff in the App Store. But I think ideally where this is all going, and apps are great and there's always a place for that, but I think ideally a lot of this stuff can survive as an HTML5 app and do quite well. And Facebook totally, you know, that's their whole thing, is they don't want to have an app for every single platform. They want to develop their HTML5 app and the touch.facebook.com, and they want to develop facebook.com, and that is it.
Yep. No, I think it's absolutely embarrassing on Apple's behalf that when I go to a website that allows me to upload a photo or upload a file, that button is just deactivated. I mean, it's just embarrassing that they don't have that kind of functionality already.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I really hope that we can make this happen.
All right. Our next article is awesome brushed metal look done entirely in CSS. Here's another entirely in CSS 3 article.
I'm curious to see what Steven's opinion on the look is.
Yeah, I want to hear this.
Yes, it's a fantastic, fantastic aluminium effect.
There it is, aluminium.
No, but it's pretty awesome how this has been done, actually, because it just saves, obviously, anything that can reduce images, the amount of images on a site, and the effects that can be done in CSS 3 is just all good stuff. And makes kittens happy.
Nice.
No, it is awesome.
I wasn't aware of that. So,
you know,
it's true.
I have an opinion too. Do you have one, Jared?
I do, but I want to hear yours first.
Okay. So my opinion is, this is awesome if it was 2005. Maybe 2003.
Ouch.
Right. When did the first brushed aluminium interface for iTunes come out, right?
Right.
I mean, it looks okay. And it looks okay to be able to pull that off in CSS is impressive. But if people all of a sudden start going and putting a bunch of brushed, you know, the look on their website, it's dating itself, and it was cool, you know, years ago.
I kind of disagree. I think that for certain things, the brushed metal look, I still think looks kind of attractive. I like it as a slider button, little things like that. Not everywhere, but, you know, little touches.
That's because you're a developer.
I'm just kidding. It is. It probably is.
I like it. I think it's more of a case of look what you can do with CSS3.
Exactly. I agree completely with that.
Yeah, and I think it's more of like, excuse me, as I said before, like, you know, reducing the amount of images is all good. So, you know, being able to do stuff like this in CSS3 is all good. So
I like the idea of the workflow being open up Photoshop, you know, if you're a designer, come up with how you want something to look ideally. But I think as CSS3 gets better implemented in browsers, I think that the final product is not an image anymore. Obviously, it's all done in CSS3. And I get really excited about that. I love the idea of being able to take these things that were traditionally only, like, just go back 3 years. You could only imagine of this being done as an image. And then here we are looking at doing it in most of the modern browsers. And granted, this does not work in anything except Safari 5.1 and Chrome Windows right now, which is pretty limiting. But these browsers are coming out with new versions every 6 weeks.
Yeah.
So this is going to be here soon. And I love the promise of that because I mean, just the time that it takes to save out those web images once you've got them in Photoshop and now they're static. Those things are set in stone. If you want to redo the size or something, you got to go back and redo all that in Photoshop, you know, change the size. CSS3 is the way to do this. And this is really cool to see people pushing the boundaries in, you know, not in a weird way. This is a pretty realistic use case right here. And I'm sure a lot of people would use this, you know, if it was cross-browser.
Yeah, I mean, this could be used in, I can imagine this being used like for like some sort of web app. Yeah. I completely agree. Amen.
All right.
So there we go.
There we go. The next article is Apple sneaks a big change in iOS 5, phasing out developer access to the UDID. And for those who don't know, the UDID is the unique device identifier within iOS. It's like a MAC address on your network card. And a lot of developers, some developers have used the UDID to be able to, you know, especially for ad networks and for certain applications, to be able to identify, okay, here's a user who has already signed in once before. They signed in on this device, so I know who they are. Whether you're doing that to save them the hassle of having to log in again. Let's say that they blow away the app and they come back and install a new version months later, and there's nothing on that device that stored who they were other than the device ID, which didn't change. Well, on the server, they saved that device ID. So when they go to log back in, boom, you would see, you know, not log back in, but they install the app and then just load up the app. They know exactly who this person is. They don't need to log in again. And that's kind of a time saver, but it's also a little wonky. But ad networks is where they really put this to great use for good or bad. They can track among all the different apps that have, let's say, AdMob code in there. They know exactly this is the same user. And if you click a conversion button in one app to go buy something in another app, or it loads up the store or whatever, they can track, okay, this is the same user, and they can see that conversion, which when Apple gets rid of this is not going to be possible anymore. So what does this affect a lot of apps? Do you think this is a big deal?
Personally, I think it's a good thing. And my take on it is, I don't really feel bad for the ad networks. Because the UDID is actually used as part of, as part of the phone's like communication, that I don't really necessarily want that number being associated to every app that I have ever downloaded and that easily accessible. So I don't have any problem with it. Yeah, it's going to cause a world of hurt. Not really. I mean, again, you know, you set a cookie. If they delete the application, they deleted it for a purpose. If they had to come and log back in, so be it. You know, yes, I think it's a big move, but I'm happy that we're getting rid of the UDID. Now, come up with some other thing that isn't tied to how like my carrier knows who I am. I'm fine with that. If they want to come out with some kind of universe, another just a UI, hell, make it a hash of the UDID, and I'm fine with it. But so I don't necessarily have any problem. Yeah, the ad networks, I'm sorry.
Right. Well, and that's what they're saying is Apple's basically saying they're going to deprecate this. It's not going away immediately, but it's been put on notice. You shouldn't build apps around this anymore. You should take existing apps that rely on it, start moving them off of it, and each app is going to be in charge of making its own unique identifier of some way, in charge of generating that and keeping track of it. Where I got kind of worried is I use a test flight app, which is a fantastic way for me and my team to be able to deploy iOS apps to clients. Have either of you guys heard of this or been in a situation where you're doing beta development on iOS apps?
Nope.
All right, let me walk you through this. What happens today if you don't use something like test flight app is you've got to have all of the people with devices who want to do the testing, they have to send you their UDIDs. Which that right there is almost a showstopper because you're usually talking to non-technical clients and you have to walk them through step by step to get you these IDs. That is required to be able to create a provisioning profile for your app so that when you distribute it to them, you know, that's what allows those devices to be able to use this beta build, which is distributed via the ad hoc mechanism. So Test Flight app makes this incredibly simple. You basically send them an email, you create them you invite them to Test Flight app, creating them this account. They click on the email, they're into the system, it collects a UDID behind the scenes and says, hey, here's the beta build for you. And all you have to do, you know, you've gone and created the new provision profile through Apple's process with their UDIDs. But it handled all of the collection of those UDIDs, which was really nice. And a couple of these guys right now are wondering, is this going to break their systems completely? And we're hoping not, because this is incredibly useful stuff. Either if it does break it, I hope that Apple immediately comes out with this type of functionality for us.
Yeah, see, I think they would almost have to, right? I mean, if they're going to get rid of the UDID, as far as, you know, test case or what was the name of it?
There are three. There's Test Flight app is the one I use. There's also App Blade and there's Hockey Kit.
Yeah, so I mean, if Apple uses them for the provisioning, then I would assume that there's going to have to be some kind of a unique identifier that they can employ to be able to say yes, this person's able to get, you know, this provisioned app. So surely they're going to come out with something. And if not, then yeah, then that's kind of again them controlling the garden. Right. So oh God, hopefully they do.
Yeah, because they will make that garden a little less of a happy place to be in.
Exactly.
All right. Our next article is Code Academy, a slick, fun way to teach yourself how to program. This is a Y Combinator startup. It was on TechCrunch a couple of days ago, and I think they pivoted recently. So Y Combinator is a startup incubator, and they do classes. So you enroll in, let's say, the summer class, and you have so many weeks. I don't remember exactly how many weeks it is, but you work under some mentors and you have a team put together and you come up with an idea and you slave away at working on that all summer. And it many times these guys pivot, and sometimes late in the summer. And these guys looked like they just pivoted right before the end of this class and before they're going to present the big, you know, their big thing to the investors. So it's kind of cool seeing what they have put together, that they did all this in such a short period of time. And it's pretty stinking nice. It's a way for people to learn programming. Even if you have had no experience doing any programming in the past, it starts off really simple for the beginner and goes up from there. And they're interactive coding lessons. So you actually are coding in a terminal window on their website, and it's just guiding you through that. And then you earn badges and you get rewarded for that and share that stuff on your social network. And yeah, I think it's a great way to get more people involved in coding, which God knows we need that.
Yeah.
I'm just on it now. This looks awesome. This looks really good.
I actually sent it to my 13-year-old daughter. And and she's like, no, of course, you know, I didn't click on it yet, but then she did. And it really is something that most people can kind of, so all I have to do is write my name in quotes, you know, and so it really does kind of baby step you through it. So this is brilliant. I love what these guys are doing, and hopefully we can get more kind of more educational places thinking about these creative ways of getting people engaged in the work they're doing versus just the, you know, some teacher standing up there and yelling words at them. So this is killer.
Yeah. And there have been other stuff like this. We've had other links on Talentopoly for these types of interactive coding tutorials. But all of the other stuff that I've seen is very focused, and it only is a few lessons around like learning how closures work or some kind of Ruby on Rails getting up to speed tutorial, set of tutorials. This, the depth of what's on this website is what's really incredible. They have a lot of lessons on here. You could spend quite a bit of time on this and hopefully become a capable programmer, you know, somewhere in the process of that.
I think it's interesting how they've got the whole badges aspect in there, because that just gives people, even though it's like something small, but it gives them like an incentive to carry on as well. I think that's pretty damn sweet.
Oh, yeah. People love badges.
I do.
All right. So if you are interested in programming or you haven't programmed in a while, go check that out. And I
no, actually, let me interject here. Okay. If you have children, I don't care if they're 8 years old or if they're 15 years old or if they're if they're any younger than eight, don't worry about it. But send this to them, because this, you know, kids today, they don't have the access. Like when we were younger, we had, you know, programming was so new and exciting, where now everything's so abstracted out from them. So send this to them and make them sit down and try it, because they're going to start getting those, that instant feedback that we all got when we were playing on the, in my hell, my generation, the Commodore 64, right? Or the Apple IIs. And just do this, and this could really alter the way that they grow up and they think about computers, and hopefully they're not just, you know, part of the sheeps that go out there and just think computers are all this black magic.
So how did you learn how to start programming, Brandon? Did you start with a book? Did you actually just sit down and start hacking? What's your method?
So my dad was doing BASIC back in, you know, 84, and so I was just blown away by all these, you know, dot matrix pieces of paper that were printed out of all this code. And so he sat down and he taught me the basics of BASIC. And I was just kind of blown away. I could say, you know, go to this line, and it would, and print hello world. And it was like, brrr, you know. So that just, that instant feedback that I had, I realized that, oh, I actually control the computer and I control technology versus technology controlling me. So that was my, you know, my dad just, again, I was 8 years old in 84. And so I, you know, it was amazing to see that I could control this device that was just so magical to me at the time. So yeah, that's my story, at least.
I started out learning how to program, you know, just reading books. I just had my nose in a, you know, like C for Dummies book and those types, yeah, of things. And I felt they
had examples, right? You had to follow the examples.
Yep. But I'd be in the car, in the backseat of the car, reading this, or, you know, even in class, reading these things in the back of the class, whatever. And I felt like I was really getting a lot out of it. But then when I would sit down to really put that to practice, there was a disconnect for me. And I realized pretty quickly that I learned a lot better through repetition and just through actual putting it to practice.
Yeah.
So I like this method of interactive lessons a lot better than books, but that's just me. I think this is the future. It's kind of cool to see that future generations may be doing much more interactive learning than just books.
Oh God, I hope so. I mean, if they're not, then we're an absolute disgrace. If we can't get our technology that we all are like really passionate about and our kids are passionate about, if we can't get that into the education system, I think our generation has failed.
Right.
And I mean, in terms of, sorry, yeah. No, in terms of like web like development, I've actually been learning Objective C so that I can eventually build and design my own iOS applications. So, but I've been learning that from a huge, thick book by Stephen Koshan, I think his name is. So, if that book and those set of lessons in that book can be put into something like Code Academy or, you know, something like that, so I just think that'd be killer, really. And so.
I mean, and it's all out there. I mean, right now somebody could go and come up with a lesson plan, because really that's what it comes down to, is how well is your lesson. Of course, we all, you know, there's all these applications out there that let you kind of learn by coding, by actually coding. But it's the lesson plans that get put together that tied together with the interactive, you know, shell, whatever the hell it's using, that really kind of merge those two, right? It's both the practice and the actual, you know, doing of it. So yeah, we've got to do this. So there's the technology's out there, people. Start coming up with great ways of doing it, and hopefully you can get your product bought by, you know, Blackboard or, you know, one of those other big education systems. So there's your motivator. You can close it for $30 million and retire young.
I think you hit on something pretty good there, Brandon. What I'd like to see, and I'm sure that Code Academy has this in mind and they're probably working towards it, is they've got the framework now. They have a nice set of lessons built in that framework, but why not open this up? Why not allow other people to create sets of lessons for very specific things and try to have, you know, out of that might come some really brilliant lessons that maybe there's a way for those to bubble to the top based on voting or the number of people that have done it or whatever, but allow this to become a platform versus them controlling all the lessons.
Love that idea.
Yeah, I hope that they're going to do that. And
do it. Talentopoly podcast says do it.
Yes, we will definitely promote the heck out of that. We love it. All right, next article, an HTML5 boilerplate add-on for CSS browser nitpicks. And this comes from Marcos Zanona. And I apologize if I'm mispronouncing that last name. What this is Raji King of Dribbble fame has done a nice post on this, and it came out of some frustration that he had trying to get a CSS style to work correctly in Chrome 13. He ran into a weird quirk in its rendering engine, and he wanted to actually have a CSS selector based on the fact that it was Chrome 13. Really simple, lightweight solution he came up with was to pop some JavaScript up there and have it insert the user agent and exactly what platform it is, like iPad device or iPhone, whatever, into the HTML so that he could then do a CSS selector based on that. And I like the solution because of how lightweight it is. And if you're needing to be able to counter the quirks of certain browsers, it seemed like a pretty nice way of doing it. Is this something you guys would look at using?
I've done it. So we do it a lot with the e-commerce sites that we have to work on, where we automatically do it. The one thing that seems to be a problem, and it could just be because we're on a .NET platform, there's a little hitch that, you know, all of the HTML loads, then the JavaScript does the detection of the user agent and then puts the body, you know, what we do is we tag it to the body and then we make our modifications from there. So there's always this little jump and it just drives the executives crazy. So that's the only thing. But yeah, it's a great workaround if you don't have access to like the raw source code to be able, because, you know, again, almost all server-side languages are going to be able to detect the user agent and be able to send that out as at rendering time,
right,
versus having to let JavaScript do it. But if you don't have that, then it's a killer workaround, and it's so insanely simple that it's just like, oh, okay, so dot iPhone dot whatever, and I customize it for the iPhone.
Yeah, I would probably prefer to do it on the server side, like you said, for the reasons you said.
Yeah,
but I like the idea of it being available in the DOM, so I can actually do selectors based on it. That was the part I really liked about it. Have you had to deal with little quirks, Steve, in certain browsers, or do you just say, you know what, forget about it?
I think as a web designer, you always come across different quirks, don't you, all over the place. But I've not really had the issue that Roger has. So, but I do appreciate, obviously, having it on the front end rather than having to delve into anything too serious. But it is a brilliant workaround.
I try not to get too complicated with my CSS. I'm not on the bleeding edge. I'm not using radial gradients and things like that. So I probably don't run into too many of these problems in my day-to-day stuff. But I think that if you are trying to do some really cool stuff, and I know there are a lot of designers out there pushing CSS3 to the max, this is probably something to look into. And
even adjusting the body, you know, or adjusting the main content area, whatever you call your top level div, right, wrapper, that you can force it to be, you know, a certain width. That can just make a huge difference in being able to have a readable website in the iPhone or a mobile device versus, you know, the full size browser.
Right. Very true. All right. Is that it on that, or do you guys have more comments?
I was going to say, I think it's worth. I'm glad, you know, there are people out there pushing CSS to the point it is, and obviously coming across these issues, because this is kind of like building a foundation, and then over time, it's just going to get easier to do things like this. And there might be a standard that, you know, W3C bring in that kind of addresses all of this much easier. For example, everybody was, you know, to create a div for your header, You know, you'd have to do div and then ID header or something like that. Whereas now, because so many people, you know, pushed for header having its own tag, HTML5 got that. So with something like what Roger's doing here, that can be a foundation for something that will be a lot easier to do in the future. So, you know, it's worth people pushing stuff like this. So, you know, that's my take on it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's okay, simple thing. It makes sense to have it up there.
And I'm not done. So my take is rounded corners and gradients and drop shadows are for those only smart enough to have a modern browser.
Hear, hear. I agree with that. And it falls back nicely. If they don't, they don't see it, but the site still works.
And it's clean and it's simple and, you know, like them.
Yes. Hopefully they are clean. We hope all browser users are clean.
Or they might be dirty.
Right. Okay.
Wow. Okay. That was your movie producer voice. Have we done the movie voiceover yet on air?
I don't know.
Okay.
Do you want to? How about this? If you want to introduce the next article about GitHub, do it in whatever voice you want, Steve. Go for it.
Yeah.
Go. How GitHub works. Be asynchronous. You.
There it is. Now, if we can only get him to get a good mic.
Yes.
Ooh, sorry. Ooh, I had to take it.
That in on air, didn't you?
I did. Yeah.
Soon enough. We just need to get some sponsors first, and then the mic will come.
Listen here, sponsors. I don't have anything else other than that.
Yeah. Okay. So GitHub, how they do work at GitHub is kind of cool. I read through this article a couple days ago and was thrilled by it. And I personally want to strive in my development when I'm working in teams with people to use this model. So here's the model that they use. They use a chat room, like a JavaScript chat room, like Campfire. I've been using HipChat recently. There are plenty of other ones out there you can look at. But they use Campfire and they're all logged into it. So they can have a conversation. They don't have to have a meeting. They don't have to go and use up 2 hours in some meeting room or something. They talk to who they need to talk to through the chat room. They have this great conversation there. They come to some kind of action items or conclusion in the chat room. And then as they're developing on that, on the stuff they talked about, if they forgot anything or if somebody else comes online and wants to see what they talked about, it's all there. It's in the chat room, which I think makes a lot of sense versus having a verbal conversation or, you know, however your emails that are just one-to-one instant message that's not there for the rest of the team. I think a single chat room makes a lot of sense. He brings up the point that if you're doing it in the chat room, you can't type nearly as much as you would say in a meeting. So you have to be less verbose. You have to be a lot more concise as a result. You have to think through what you're going to say before you say it. It leads to a higher quality, shorter, more concise conversation. And I buy into that. I think that's kind of cool. The next thing that they do is pull requests. This is a big thing that GitHub has added as a feature recently. And what they do is they will take somebody's code, create a branch off of it, make the changes that they want to have pulled back into trunk, and then they issue a pull request to the owner of the code to say, hey, look at this code, tell me what you think about it. If it's good, let's pull it in. If not, let's make whatever changes are necessary to it. Let's iterate on it. And the final thing that he says in here is that meetings are fucking toxic. You do not want to have meetings.
Ooh,
yes. That's how passionate I am about how bad meetings are. I hate meetings. I think that they become a crux in a lot of corporations. I think that people just fall into that culture, even though it doesn't really provide a lot of value. And he says, just don't have them. At GitHub, in the however long he's worked there, over a year or so, he said he can count the number of meetings he's been in on one hand, and it allows him to stay in the zone. All of this stuff is asynchronous. He can get that 4 to 6 hours worth of in the zone time and be highly productive, and that is awesome to me. All right, guys, opinions.
Steven, do you have some?
I have an opinion on the meetings part, which I just completely agree with Jared. You know, I mean, I'm just remembering meetings I've been in the past where the meetings have just gone on for hours over some stupid points that could have just been solved right then, and then you happen to write them down in a book and then go back to your desk and no thanks. So that's my thought on that.
And my opinion is this is Enterprise Corporation 2.0 versus the Corporation 1.0, which the majority of us probably work in. I think a lot of the points that they make in this article relate directly to kind of the results only results only work environment. That it's let's get rid of all of the bullshit that exists within our systems and let's start leveraging technology where it really fits. So like in my group, while it's a completely small group, everybody else and every other team in our company has meetings, and they have an hour and a half, 2 hour long meetings, and they go in there and they talk about what they ate and what was funny, and really nothing gets accomplished. Same thing here is where Patrick and I can honestly talk about the number of meetings that we've actually had on one hand, because every time we go out to Starbucks or every time we go and we talk outside, we're having our meetings. You know, we're communicating on kind of what we need to get done. So this is definitely where I think it's all going to go in the future. I just hope corporations could make this happen sooner. Unfortunately, I don't see them doing because they're big, slow dinosaurs.
Yep.
Yeah, and those corporations are still using IE6, so... Damn them.
Exactly.
So.
All right. Last article. 20 amazing examples of using media queries for responsive web design. And this was your article, Steve, so I will let you kind of summarize it.
Awesome. Yes. So responsive web design is like a hot topic amongst, you know, web designers and developers at the moment. And it has been since last year. I think it was Ethan Marcotte who coined the term, and he's written a book on it actually as well, which I'm in the midst of reading. So what is like responsive web design? It's basically having a website that responds to whatever browser is, you know, viewing the site, and obviously screen resolution as well. So this article just gives you 20 examples of how you can use media queries to make your site responsive. And I really think this is like how web design should be done. You know, I mean, I don't think you should have websites that if someone's got a netbook and they're browsing your site, then the experience is constricted and they have to use scroll bars all over the place. Just like, for example, if you're on an iPhone and you're browsing nytimes.com, you're having to double tap to one story, double tap again to come out, or, you know, flick left, right, and all over the place. So what media queries will do with responsive web design is make everything adapt to that screen size and resolution so that the experience is just so, you know, it's just slick and it's the same as it would be on a desktop. So have you guys been responding with this?
I've been wanting to implement this on Talentopoly, so it's also on my I'm too lazy to do this list. And to me, the promise here is that you don't have to create a separate website for the mobile side. You can just say this CSS is going to work on any size screen, and it's an optimized experience on every size screen, and I love that.
One of the things I love about it, though, as well, is the fact that it doesn't push you, but it kind of wills you into creating truly clean and, you know, semantic code, you know. So yeah, having images at, like, for example, 100%, and then those images can be scaled down, it kind of makes you rethink things in a way to produce a beautifully developed website. So that's just one of the positives as well with responsive web design.
And my take on the whole thing is when you're developing your new apps and you're developing all this great software, you develop first for the – and again, I'll always use iPhone and iPad, but that can be synonymous with you know, whatever mobile platform you're using and whatever tablet platform you're using. But focus there first and then make it look good in the web browser. And really, because, again, the world is mobile. So the responsive web design, I think it's an absolute requirement that you have now. If I go to your website and it's not adapted for my device that I'm looking at, I'm not going to sit there and waste a bunch of time on it. So if you're not looking into this, you need to be. And so from a side project that I've got going on, again, with Patrick Dow, who I've now dropped like the name five times. Patrick Dow. You know, the main thing is I want it to work great on the iPad and the iPhone, and then I'll worry about the browser.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, I think it's time to wrap up this episode. If you'd like to be mentioned on a future episode of the Talentopoly podcast, check out talentopoly.com post a link to something you're reading or a tool you find useful. And if we pick it, we will mention you along with the article on that week's podcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.